Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a space for those who are healing from complex and developmental trauma. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach, survivor, and thriver. The intent of the podcast is to provide helpful information with insight that can validate, encourage, and support you on your healing journey. You're going to hear stories from other survivors and trauma experts, featuring therapists, coaches, and practitioners. We will open up the conversation on effective trauma healing modalities, practices, and tools. If you are interested in trauma recovery coaching, as well as recommended books and healing resources, head over to www.thehealingtraumapodcast.com. And now, here is your host, Monique Coven.
Welcome back, everyone. So this past week, the podcast has hit over 1 million downloads. It kind of blew me away because I remember when I started the podcast, I really was thinking that maybe a few people will listen and I'll talk about trauma and what I've learned, and hopefully a few people will feel less alone and they'll have some understanding of what's going on with them. And I was recording often in my basement or in my car off my iPhone. And I did that for a while, and the podcast has just grown, which just goes to show you how much trauma there is and how people are really impacted by trauma and are wanting to heal. I remember when I was experiencing trauma symptoms, and I thought I was the only one. I looked around and it didn't seem that other people had come from, you know, I'm using the word that used to be used to describe dysfunctional family or dysfunctional home, which is a very mild word for what many of us have actually experienced. And I felt just so alone. And also when I was going through my trying to figure out what was going on, there was no answers. There was no help. And so I'm just so pleased that I can be a part of this, and that I hope this podcast is offering you hope for healing and pointing you in a direction of healing. So let's go on to today's episode. Today I am talking to Colleen West, and Colleen has a trauma-informed practice in San Francisco. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist and an EMDRIA approved consultant. She employs a phase-oriented treatment approach, which includes a number of parts models, including IFS, which is internal family systems, structural dissociation, and EMDR in her work with clients and clinicians. So I'm going to be basing our conversation off of her book, which was really helpful in understanding parts work. When I found her book, I was interested in learning more about parts work. And so the conversation will be touching on different pieces that are in the book. So I really hope this episode is helpful for you. Hi, Colleen. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Monique. Glad to be here.
So I think what I'd love is if you could, from, you know, the way that you do it, explain in your words how you understand what we hear a lot talked about, our window of tolerance. What do we mean by our window of tolerance?
Yeah. Well, you know, I come to this, I see myself now as an IFS therapist primarily, but I came to this work as a trauma therapist working, first trained psychodynamically, and then I moved into doing EMDR, and then I became an EMDR consultant. And you know, when you start getting a whole lot of referrals for people who have severe trauma, you wind up having to get a whole bunch of new skills. And one of the things that I learned about was how the autonomic nervous system, this thing that we're built with to protect us, to aid in our survival, is actually something we have to befriend when we're in therapy. Because if we have had repeated relational violations, as so many of us have in childhood, basically when we show up in therapy, we have parts that are scared. And they, you know, because this is a relationship, right? And so it brings up a whole lot of relational trauma, and that will push us out of the window of tolerance. So we'll go into fight, flight, freeze, right? And those will push us above the window of tolerance. This is a neurobiological term, but we've adapted it. We've sort of embraced it as a way to check and see, are we okay? Are we in a workable space, right? Can some work happen between me and you? And so, and the beauty of IFS is that it adds the element of self or self energy, and something that we all have. And self energy creates a wide window of tolerance. Long-term trauma creates a very small window of tolerance, because, and I can go into lots more detail on that, but a small window of tolerance is basically that we can't tolerate too much emotion, too much input, without going into fight, flight, freeze, or attach or submit, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's so important, because I can't imagine going for therapy without somebody having a polyvagal or nervous system lens, because all of that is going to just be missed. And then you're missing the ability to be able to really connect with that person in front of you. So yeah, that was a great way of explaining that. So, okay. You know, in your little book with big ideas that I love, you talk about your symptoms are memories. And I thought that was such a powerful statement. So what do you mean our symptoms are memories?
Yeah. Well, one of the legacies of trauma and neglect is that you spend so much of your days basically in flashback, right? And a flashback is the reactivation or the reliving of a memory. But it's not usually with pictures, you know, it's not usually the time mom didn't pick me up or the 50th time mom forgot to pick me up. It's not usually with pictures. It's usually a body sensation, a whole set of body sensations and feelings. And those things are a way that memories are present. And so I call them often flashbacks, or I call them memories, you know. And the thing about the severely traumatized person is that they're reliving most of the time, reliving the past, because it doesn't take that much to throw them into fear, right? So I wanted to just help people understand that they're not crazy at all. They're not weird. They're not, you know, this is a very normal response to trauma.
Yeah. So your symptoms is memories. So for example, if somebody is feeling suddenly afraid or very afraid, are you saying that it's not necessarily what's happening now, but that?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. People really get a lot from just saying I'm in a flashback.
Yeah.
And a flashback is the activation of parts that are responding to some stimulus in the present, but they're doing it through, you know, the lens of a little kid. And so it just always feels so much worse than it would now. You know, if you, you know, there's a few things that would trigger me. I was on the phone with a psychiatrist the other day, and they were just, we share a client, and they were just patently denying that this client was as traumatized as she is. And I kept redoubling my efforts, and finally I just kind of dropped back into self. And I was like, wow, I was really out of the window there. And that was a memory, like a body memory, of not being listened to, of being dominated, right? By somebody who has a lot more authority than I do in the world, right? So there it was in a little nutshell.
Yes. And that's such a great example. And I think that's one of the things that I wasn't clear about when I was going into flashbacks, you know, in the early days and stuff. And then it's really scary because it feels like we have no agency and that we're still that small child, but that something in the present, our brains are really magnificent at keeping us safe. And they're saying, you know, that, like with what you're saying, you know, that guy, that psychiatrist, he's really like that person in the past. And so we start to feel that energy of like, okay, you better do something now. And the feeling, especially when we don't understand, really feels very overwhelming. So yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Just being able to tease that apart in advance. Like I'm feeling flooded right now, but I know I'm essentially safe.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a huge, huge step.
Yes. And I, you know, you talk about you being an IFS therapist and trainer. I'm wondering, so how would IFS deal with that? If a client came to you and said, yeah, I got really triggered by this person and I just retreated into myself. How would they approach that?
Yeah, well, I have two ways to answer that. So the standard IFS approach would be to help the client talk to that part that got activated, right? If they're not able to do that, then the next step would be for me to talk directly to that part. And sometimes that's just exactly what's needed, and the part can basically access some self energy in the client and maybe use a little of my self energy, and self energy brings a part into the window of tolerance. So it's a kind of magical thing. But I have another way of answering that, which is some people are so highly traumatized. They had no good attachment early in life, which is what creates that window of tolerance, right? Someone who's reliable and responsive, that they may just be right, you know, like on the ceiling in your therapy office. And then it's going to be really hard to just use standard IFS. I really love Frank Anderson's new book, Transcending Trauma. And he brings in a lot of this neurobiological knowledge that we have and some of the science. And I love how that's a link between IFS, pure IFS, and this kind of more trauma-informed lens. I also have been working in that gap between the two for a lot of years. So that's what interests me.
Yes. Yeah. He's been on the podcast, by the way. He's amazing.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, our autonomic defenses are protection. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah. Well, I want you to think for a moment that you and I and everybody listening is a product of thousands of generations of human beings, right? That our ancestors were the ones who survived everything, or we wouldn't be here, right? So there's a whole lot about us that is wired for survival. And if, you know, if we had ancestors who weren't that well wired, they might have just bitten the dust, right? But our ancestors knew when we should flee something dangerous, knew when we should fight something dangerous, knew when we should freeze, right? Freeze is like an animal playing dead, right? Because predators don't like to eat dead things usually. And so if you're, in this state where you look kind of dead, then you're much less of a target to a predator, right? So it's archaic, it's in the archaic brain. But then attach and submit are also essential for our survival, because when we were babies, we needed to cement that bond with our caregiver, right? From the get-go, that all that attachment was happening both ways, with our parent and between us on both sides. And then submit is the response if you really don't have another alternative. You can't get out of the situation. Attaching isn't working. Submitting is a way that you make yourself small and less of a target, less of a threat to whoever's aggressing on you. As one who learned how to submit early and often, and it's taken me a lifetime to work through that, oh man, submit is a big one. Yeah. Oop. No audio.
Yeah. I'm thinking about, so many people might think that this is just who I am. I'm a nice person. I always want to make people happy. I like to do nice things. And when they start to realize that actually this was a very useful, helpful, life helpful, self-protective mechanism that was learned early, and that it still kind of gets wired in there, and it happens so quickly that, when you start to understand that this is also an autonomic adaption, it helps you to rethink that and find ways to maybe not say yes so much, or maybe say no. And of course, that will be totally terrifying at the beginning, because that feels very unsafe at first, but recognizing that that's just an adaption that might not be who you are, but who you had to be in order to be safe. Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And submit is something that it's not in our true nature. I think it's really important. Those moments, and everybody's had them, when they are in self, when they're in their Buddha nature, when they're with their soul, the soul of their soul, they don't have to submit. They don't wish to submit. They're confident. They're full of life. They're humorous. They're alive. They may choose to be of service, but that's not submit.
I totally get that as you're saying that. If you don't have that threat right there and you think about, what do I really want to do? If there was no threat around, maybe I don't want to do it,
Nothing.
Yeah. So here's another one that you talk about in your book, about what we learned about being close. I think this is so important. It's about attachment. Can you talk a bit about that?
You should probably give me a more specific question because okay. I could talk for a long time on that.
Okay. Okay. So what I'm thinking about is this. A lot of trauma survivors want close relationships. That's what they want. But yet they're sometimes they may approach it and start to feel like suffocated or I don't think so, or too close. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Got it. It's really, you know, there's many, many trauma survivors function extremely well in the world. And by that, I mean in the world of work, because there are clear rules, they can, you know, they show up, they have striving parts, they're amazing in the work world, but then in their personal lives, they feel at a deficit. Why is that? Because relationships are so complicated. They're just a zillion bits of information coming at us at once. And we have to negotiate those somehow. And in order to have a sustained relationship, we have to be able to have some window of tolerance. We have to have some sense of, I can go out of safety here because some interaction was just difficult, but then I can come back into safety and trust that this other person will join me there, right? But trauma survivors so often have these hardwired reactions that started very early in life, that people aren't safe or in a whole different variety of ways not safe, right? So this caregiver was neglectful, just not there when I needed them. Or this caregiver was intrusive, right? Or this caregiver fed me on a schedule instead of when I needed to be fed. I mean, so many, many different ways. This caregiver was nice 90% of the time, and then 10% of the time, they lost it and yelled at me. So I've got all of that data hardwired into me. And all it takes is certainly comes up in intimate relationships the worst, but in any relationship, in friendships, in parent-child relationships, if somebody acts somewhat like that early trigger, all that cascade of procedurally learned material is going to be present. There again, the past is present, or I'm in a body memory. And so then we're not very good at responding to the moment. We go into our parts. We're not able to be in any amount of self. We blend with a part in order to be safe. But that's not good for relationships, right? In my first marriage, I was so often triggered into anger that I just kept, and I didn't want to fight every day, all day long. So I would leave, right? I would leave the room to de-escalate, but it was impossible to get through anything that way. Very painful. And I have so much empathy for people trying to do this. You know, the me I was 30 years ago it's tough.
Oh yes. And that's why I'm so grateful that we can have this conversation, because when you're going through that, you think, what the heck is wrong with me? I'm such a unstable, bad person. When it's none of that, you know, this is our biology that is responding. And so when we understand it, we can have some self-compassion and then, you know, learn to do something about it. One of the things I forgot to ask you, I think because I know what it is, but I'm wondering that maybe some of the listening audience may not know. You talked a few times about the term self-energy. Could you tell us what you mean by self-energy?
Yeah. You know, Richard Schwartz, the guy who came up with IFS in collaboration with many people, but he was the brilliant person behind it. he just named self as being the, you know, this, the essential you, the you who's talking to me right now. And it's self is not parts, right? So it's the essence of us. It's, as I start many meditations with my students, it's that spark of you that is only yours. It's never, it will never exist again. You know, when Monique goes, her little spark will go too. And maybe not, maybe there's something else, but it is that unique, incredible essence of us, and everybody has it. But parts eclipse it. Parts, you know, when they blend with us for us to get into some sense of safety, then self isn't very present. Self is also a bigger concept than that. That's like the personal sense of self. There's also this self that's more global, that many people feel when they've chanted in a group of people, or when they sing in a chorus together, or after a particularly beautiful meditation. There's a sense of self that isn't mine or yours, but it's oneness. And so as we say in IFS, it's both a wave and a particle. The particle is my sense of self, and the wave is we're all one. And that does happen sometimes, right?
Yeah, so I love that. And I love that distinction, because it reminds us that the self is the untraumatized part. And it's the part that we came into the world as, and it can't be traumatized. Yeah, I love that. I love that.
I love that too.
Yeah. And I think that we get to touch into that when we're in our state of safety and connection, our ventral state of connection, when we really feel present, when we're not sensing any threat around us, when we're able to take in, you know, some of the goodness around us, that the when it feels real good, you know.
That's right. That's yeah. right. And yeah. when we feel safe to connect, that's self-energy. And yet there are many ways we can get into self. You know, many, many people feel the present, the presence of their self energy when they're in nature, you know, or when they're just seeing something that's so beautiful that, you know, it just makes their eyes water, you know?
Yeah. That's so lovely. So you talk, I mean, I know in IFS there's different parts, and some of them have names. Like, I'm going to talk about one of the big ones, our protectors. We have protectors. Could you talk a bit about that? Protectors. What are protectors?
Yeah. You know, most people, most trauma survivors find that just learning about the three kinds of parts in IFS is so illuminating, and it allows them to just relax, because it describes something that we've all been experiencing, but we didn't have words for. So protectors come in two varieties. There are managers and firefighters. Managers are proactive. Firefighters are reactive. Managers are focused on the future. They help us plan, strive, grow, set up appointments for Zoom meetings. I mean, all the stuff that they do, and we need them. That we absolutely need them. Firefighters are the emergency workers of the IFS system and all of our systems. They are now oriented, right? So they don't plan. They are very, we need them too. They're the ways, they're pleasure seeking a lot of times. They help us drop into the moment sometimes. They help us shift gears. Everybody has firefighters. But just like any part in our internal system, they can be extreme. And so firefighters can be responsible for addictive behaviors like, you know, soothing with food, for example, when we're not hungry, and you know, or all the way up to heroin or opioids, right? They are a way of getting us out of pain. And, but in a healthier version, they're just, oh, you know, I've had a long day. I'm tired. I'm going to shift gears by, you know, watching the news and having a glass of wine, you know, so they can be, you know, any of our parts can be very healthy and unburdened, or they can be very burdened and polarized in our internal system, which causes grief and chaos. But the third kind of part, which you haven't asked me about, are exiles. And those are the vulnerable parts of us that hold our history of trauma, neglect, vulnerability. Even in a healthy family and upbringing, exiles do pick up burdens. And so they, you know, they need to heal.
So for complex trauma survivors, I guess when younger, so if something happens and it might remind us of the past and we start to feel this younger part that might be afraid, that would be an exile.
Not all the time. The interesting thing is that protectors are often very, very young also. And so they're often the age or close to the age of the exile that they protect. And so you can feel triggered in any way into a manager, you know, like my cleaning manager, my organizing manager, my whatever, and feel young when I'm in that triggered state. Same way with a firefighter, like, oh, hell no, you're not going to do that to me, right? An angry firefighter, well, you know, I can feel pretty young when I'm in those states. But yes, often it's an exile that's triggered as well.
Okay. So there's a really beautiful thing about IFS that I love, and you hear this a lot, which is all parts are welcome. So it's really giving a welcome and like a non-shame response to when we're acting a certain way. Can you talk a bit about that? All parts are welcome.
I think that's really the essence of the of what I love about the model, is that no part inside is denigrated. They're all welcome as being important to your system and important in telling your story, important in helping you function, that even the ones that cause people a lot of trouble, like a part that gives you OCD or a part that makes you completely compulsive about using alcohol or whatever, is really trying to help in some way, has a positive intent. So the beauty of IFS and the way IFS therapists are trained is that they have to be able to look at their own system, those parts of us that tend to judge or weight certain parts over other parts. Like if I'm treating an addiction and, you know, here's this 18-year-old kid in my office and I really, really want them to stop using fill in the blank, whatever their substance is, because it's dangerous. And I inadvertently say, well, maybe you could use a little less. I'm not welcoming all parts, right? So welcoming that part that's using and helping all, you know, everybody concerned to understand the positive intention it has will go a lot further than, you know, we don't really want you here. So.
Yeah, it's making me think about, I mean, I don't know that much about, I've never worked in any kind of drug and alcohol rehabilitation or anything, but gee, if they talked a bit about the positive intent, I think that would probably really soften some of the clients.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully they do.
Yeah. IFS is really taking off, and I hope it just continues to mushroom the way it is. But Yeah, there's wonderful work. You know, Gabor Mate is doing wonderful work in the same way of welcoming the addiction as a messenger about the pain that is in that person's system that needs soothing.
So,
there's a lot of good work around that now.
Yes, that is so great. Well, the last thing I wanted to talk to you about, which is something that I don't think I've talked to anybody about it, but I wanted to talk to you about it because I know that you know about this, and that is, what have you learned that would be helpful for therapists and clients to understand about pre-verbal trauma, pre-verbal, before we have the language?
This is my own particular strong interest, and I don't know how much time we have, but again, you may have to rein me in. But the reason I've become so fascinated with it is because I consult with lots and lots of therapists and have consultation groups for them, and the kind of client they bring over and over again is not the client with a terrible abuse history. It's the client that they don't have any big T traumas in their background, but something went wrong. And they are the kind of person who feels like they just don't get better in therapy. They're often the clients that end up sort of neglected by their therapists because they're perfectly benign. They're perfectly conversational. They also show up on time. They are very organized. They have very competent managers, right? They look good on the outside, but they are so lonely and so resistant to change. Their parts are very resistant to change. And so I had to find out, what the heck's going on? Why can't these people really take advantage of therapy? They stay a long time, but they may have very little change. And so I began looking earlier and earlier and earlier and began to study attachment. And preverbal trauma is procedurally learned. So it's learned by experience, day in, day out experience. And so we don't have explicit memories of it. So, you know, if we were a baby, even a fetus, a baby, a toddler, you know, anything under, I say under three, but it's really mostly under 2 years old, we don't remember it, but yet it's all baked in. All those relational patterns are baked in, and the protectors that need to protect from whatever didn't happen, right? Those protectors are so young too, that they're very often very reluctant to talk. They're very reluctant to kind of open up in therapy. So they're kind of locked down. So it's a different animal, you know, in a way than a highly chaotic, abusive home produces. In fact, a lot of times the parents look really good. The community thinks the parents are doing great, and the parents are striving to be good parents, but they're missing relational capacity that was needed. And talk about the past being present for those parents. They're in their parts. They're not in self with their baby. So,
yeah. And what about those who have experienced trauma at either under two or under three, but they don't have sort of the pictures of what happened. They just have the body memory. So they don't have the verbal. How are you able to work with those parts to make them tell their story or heal?
Yeah. Well, I believe there's quite a bit of time at the beginning, even of an IFS therapy, where you're doing relationship building with the client's system of parts, even if you're not talking about parts, because their parts are present and listening and getting to know you, the therapist, and getting to trust you, the therapist. So I think there's relationship building, but when there's enough safety and they are able to access some self-energy themselves, which also can be a process, then pre-verbal parts come forward just like any other post-verbal part. Very often they come first as a body sensation, and then the part will start having feelings or helping the client feel their feelings. And then they'll have thoughts, and sometimes they have words too, because they can kind of interpret what their experience is at that time. It's amazing. I have healed a lot of pre-verbal parts, and they don't talk, but they convey their experience very clearly. Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah. And I know even in my own work, you know, I said at the beginning, like, I have no verbal and a verbal, you know, visual memories, but yet a little bit, but not that much. And yet I remember during one session, actually having an image of me showing popping up in a high chair and seeing things. I'm like, whoa.
That's so, right.
Yeah. So
that's how it works.
Yeah. Which is really, really amazing. Yeah. So Colleen, this was so great. Thank you for letting me ask you all of those questions. And I will put a link up to your book, because it's a little book with big ideas about healing trauma. And I love it. And I loved our conversation together. Is there anything else before we close that you would like to say?
Yes. I'm thrilled that just this past week, my book has been published in Spanish and French and Korean. So, but the Spanish and French versions just went live on my website, smarttherapytools.com, and on Amazon. And so you can get them in print or ebook all around the world. And I'm super excited about that. So, because it's going to be helping more people. So it's also on the IFS website, the IFS Institute website.
Great. Well, I'll link your website in the show notes. So again, thank you for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it.
I'm delighted to have met you, Monique, and to talk about my favorite subject. So thank you. Right.
Trauma recovery is about finding safety. Safety, firstly, in our bodies, and then in our experience, in relationships with others. And so part of the work that I do as a trauma recovery coach is help you to begin to get unstuck in those responses that are really in the body. As we know, trauma doesn't live in our thoughts or in our cognitions. Yes, our thoughts play a part, but it begins in our somatic experience. Through the coaching experience, I will give you tools and support to help you to begin to move through those responses where you often find yourself stuck. To find out more about my trauma recovery coaching offerings, you can visit my website at www.thehealingtraumapodcast.com.